Survivor's Guide to True Crime includes discussions of sexually based violence and is not intended for children. Information provided should not be used as a substitute for professional medical or legal advice. Please exercise discretion and self-care.
Welcome back to Survivor's Guide to True Crime. I'm Kim.
And I'm Kara.
Thrilled. Thrilled for this interview. I can't tell you how many times I picked up my pink freak flag and flew it proudly. Multiple pink flags.
So we always do a little informational, like quick calls with people just to see if it's a good fit for everyone, give them the rundown of what we do. And when we had this informational call, you'll hear me talk about it on the podcast. I looked at Kim because it was a video call and I was like, she is biting her tongue so hard. I am concerned. I just knew that this is going to be so up her alley. And you're not going to hear me much in this podcast because I'm just sitting back and learning and listening. And so it is slightly infuriating. But hopefully it leaves you infuriated and motivated.
It was just, I could have listened to her for hours. We are very excited to be welcoming Nicole Badera. I'm sorry, Dr. Nicole Badera.
Fancy.
Yeah. Sociologist and author of the forthcoming book, On the Wrong Side, How Universities Protect Perpetrators and Betray Survivors of Sexual Violence. That book comes out on October 8th. It's already available for pre-order at the time that we are recording this. So she's going to give you your call to action at the end and tell you the best way to order or purchase that book, which I highly, highly suggest you do. Her research broadly focuses on how our social structures contribute to survivors' trauma and make sexual violence more likely to occur in the future.
Her scholarship has influenced sexual violence prevention programming across the country, including for Planned Parenthood. And her work has been featured in many popular outlets, including the New York Times, NPR, Time Magazine, and Teen Vogue. Nicole puts her work into practice as an affiliated educator at the Center for Institutional Courage and as a co-founder of Beyond Compliance Consulting.
Here's our conversation with Nicole. Welcome to the conversation, Nicole. We are so excited to have you.
I am so excited to be here. I can't wait to chat today.
For those of you who can't see, I came prepared with my freak flags a-flying. Two, not one, two. This is two. A two-flag interview.
Two of them. And you will soon find out why, because we had our little intro call and Kim was biting her tongue harder than I've ever seen her bite her tongue before. And I was like, go ahead, Kim, because this is all so up your alley. So we are super excited for this interview. But Nicole, before we get any further into this, let's do the icebreaker first, even though I feel like the ice has been sufficiently broken, because before we started recording, I was talking about a rash in my armpit. So just so we're clear on what's going on in my life, I'm sitting on the floor in the closet with a rash on one of my armpits. So now that you guys know where we're at, Nicole, your icebreaker, your version of the icebreaker, when's the last time you had an armpit rash? I'm just kidding.
Oh my God. Far too recently, I'll say that.
I'm just kidding. What have you been currently binging? What's the last thing that you binged?
Ooh.
It could be TV, food, movies, books, whatever.
You know, I did The Secret Lives of Mormon Wives is the last thing I binged. I went to undergrad in Salt Lake City, and so I can't avoid it. I am fascinated for the rest of my life in especially the way that sort of Utah culture looks outside of Utah.
Right.
So I do all of those shows, absolutely all of them.
Already flown her flag.
So I do not care for reality TV in the least. Like, I watched Rock of Love. Do you remember Rock of Love? Like, way back. Bret Michaels. It was like my college turn your brain off.
I didn't watch it, but yeah.
Yeah. So that long ago. And this one, I actually sat down and turned on and was like, oh my gosh, I can hear myself getting dumber, but also I want to know the things.
It's so fascinating. I got really sucked into a lot of reality TV pretty early in my PhD. I took a class on qualitative research methods, and the professor told us that sociologists do not think like normal people, and that the longer you're in this work, the farther you'll get divorced from how just ordinary people think about things. And so you need to watch a lot of TV, and you need to pick TV that you think really kind of captures the cultural moment. So for me, it turned into reality TV, especially the ones that do tend to have themes of violence, sex, dating, all these things that I talk about all the time. And, you know, it took one episode for Secret Lives of Mormon Wives to fit into that category. Mm-hmm. And I'm here. I have thoughts.
That's so interesting because I feel like when I consume reality TV, it again is rarely, but it's the same reason I consume romantasy books. It's because I want my brain to be shut off. My brain is going on intellectual things a lot during the day. And so I need to consume those things. So I thought that's where you were going, but you actually went somewhere different. And that's so interesting.
Yeah, the opposite. One of the reasons I like reality TV in general more than most scripted TV, because there's the whole sociologist kind of peering in, producers have a lot in common with researchers in some ways, they're trying to create these environments. But the other piece of it is that I am really interested in what people do when they think it's kind of mindless, when they think that there's sort of no responsibility because this is just having cameras on and what happens. But the other thing that I find interesting about it is the way people talk about sexual violence in reality TV is often a lot less gruesome than in scripted TV. In some ways, it's more gruesome because it is real. People do get sexually assaulted on reality TV sets. That does happen. But I find it more recognizable. As a sexual violence researcher and expert, I am sometimes horrified by the fantasies that I have seen written into scripted television, especially when there are very few women involved in the production process. At least the types of violence that I see in reality TV feel familiar. And I'm not altogether horrified all over again.
Yeah, because they're real as opposed to sensationalized, I guess.
Yeah, because it is absolutely happening. I always am interested in how they spin it and how do they create their storyline as opposed to what actually is happening. So I had taken a psychology class in grad school and it was my favorite by far and away. I think I've said that on here before. It was a summer class and like you had to give up your weekends and I would have brought my sleeping bag and stayed overnight just to like, oh, let's listen. So extreme religious movements are of high interest to me for the same reasons as anyone can find themselves as a part of a cult. Mm-hmm. Anyone can find themselves as a victim of crime. And I loved that. Loved that. Weird way to put it, but I like and appreciate that through line because truly it plays upon our humanity. And the way that you bring people into a cult is much the same as the way that you would bring them into a domestic violence relationship.
Yeah, it's funny. I've been doing a lot of podcasts because I have a book that just came out this week. And that's one of the genres of podcasts that I get invited to speak on a lot is podcasts about cults. Because the similarities and the power dynamics, they're not that different from thing to thing. And whether you're talking about cults or the medical system or you're trying to get something out of your car insurance company, these power dynamics where somebody else controls everything for you create a lot of harm, a lot of stress, and yeah, a lot of violence as well. So there's a ton of overlap. Anywhere where things just feel fundamentally unfair, you'll find some overlap with discussions on sexual violence.
So with that in mind, Nicole, go ahead and introduce yourself to our audience. Tell us a little bit about your background to your comfort level.
I got into this work, a little over 10 years ago as a victim advocate. And in that role, I was working alongside victims in the hospitals. So during their forensic exams, people might know them as rape kits. And it's a fundamentally horrible thing to take someone who's been sexually assaulted and often mere hours later, ask them to get undressed in a room full of strangers again, to be dehumanized and objectified and turned into evidence instead of a person. Because in our criminal justice system, that's what a victim is. The victim is not in control of the case. They don't get to pick the decisions made in the legal strategy. They don't get to decide to walk away from all of it. Sometimes that'll happen, but a lot of the time it can go on without them. And you become less of a person. You're being treated as a side character in your perpetrator's story of what happens to overwhelmingly him next. And so in that role, I would get a lot of questions from victims about why did this happen to me? Why does the system work this way? Is it my fault that things are going so badly? And I thought I would feel better if I came forward, but instead I'm feeling a lot worse. I didn't like the answers that were available for those questions. A lot of the time, the research in that moment would blame the victim and say, you're here because you did X, Y, and Z wrong. And here's everything that makes you not a perfect victim. And that was not an answer I wanted to give anybody. And to be clear, it was not an answer that my employer thought we should give anybody either. But it's a good question. These questions of why is this happening and why does it continue to happen and why is nobody doing about it were really interesting to me. So I went to graduate school to get a PhD in sociology, and I landed on studying college sexual assault really out of luck. really just because when I started doing this work, I needed a data set that was nearby. And a lot of researchers study their own universities, especially at the undergraduate level, which is, I started doing this while I was still an undergrad. You know how many resources you just look for where you are. And then this national discussion erupted around campus sexual violence right around the same time. And so I stayed there. And one of the reasons I decided to stay studying campus sexual violence is because our universities are the place that introduce the most powerful adults in our society to the norms of adulthood. And so when we think about who's going to decide what's normal in a workplace, what kinds of things we speak up about, what kinds of things do we turn the other way, we think about it from a perpetrator side of what they're learning about how to commit violence without detection and how to benefit from that violence. Those things will follow well beyond our college campuses. And so that's the reason I stuck with studying college sexual assault. And again, like we were saying before with the reality TV shows, it didn't feel that different. The structures and the inequality, it just felt like you could kind of pick anywhere and none of that stuff would change all that much.
Okay, so you understand now, everyone, why my freak flags are a flying. I about said, okay, wait, slow down and say those words while you hold our hands. But tell us about that power dynamic a little more. So not just in colleges. Because when we were first talking about this, I was asking, how does that apply to larger systems? Because maybe not everybody is a current student or didn't go to a traditional four-year university. And while this is your place of study and what you are focusing on, especially with your book, tell us what that's going to look like. Set the stage for us.
So the first thing that comes to mind is just to give an example of how some of these power dynamics follow us into whatever institution we're inhabiting. And the example that comes to mind is that feeling you get when you're on the phone with your healthcare provider and they are telling you that the medication that all the experts in the room think you need, you cannot have because your insurance company has some archaic rule. If you've been through this experience, you know that there's often not a lot you can do about it. That there are some people who might be able to try to change the insurance company's mind, or they might make some recommendations about ways that we can maybe use a different code. And there's some ways to work within the system a little bit, and having a provider who will do that matters. But ultimately, there is no oversight for your insurance company. They get to set their own policies and procedures. They can change them whenever they want, which again, a lot of us have experienced, where you have a medication that they've covered for such a long time, and now they suddenly don't cover it. It costs more. They've changed the brand and you're allergic to that brand. And there's really no one to appeal to. And even the idea of who do you appeal to? Where do you start? You have this phone number that anybody who's called one of those phone trees knows that you spend hours just being kicked from person to person with everybody telling you that it's not their responsibility. It's not their fault. And that dynamic of the organization having all of this control for themselves and nobody else can really help you because they're outside the system, that's what happens in sexual assault proceedings too. Whether it's happening on a college campus or HR at your university, or if you're going to the police, there's nobody else who really has a lot of jurisdiction over their decisions either. You'll find that people are making crucial decisions about your life, about your safety, about your health, and you don't actually get much autonomy or agency in those decisions. That's the through line throughout really every component of the book, but also throughout society as a whole. You know, the book now has been out for just a few days. I have been really humbled and delighted by how many people got the book and read it all at once and have sent me their thoughts. So if you're listening to this and that's you and you've already read the book and you have something that you want to say, I really actually want to hear it a lot. I've been working on this project for 8 years, holding this largely by myself. I'm so eager to hear what is resonating with people. But one of the things that people keep saying is, this doesn't just make me think of a college campus. This makes me think of this situation over here, or this situation over there. Just any time that we have a legitimate need, that we're hurting, and there's somebody standing in the way, and not just standing in the way, but making it worse. And so a situation that was already bad is now compounded and way worse than it would have been otherwise.
Yes. Tell us about the premise of the book, because, you know, you sent it over to Kara and I. This sounds really messed up. I'm saving it for my beach read. I'm going on vacation next week. And I started looking at it and I was like, oh my gosh, I'm going to shirk all other responsibilities and only focus on this. And I need a highlighter with my margins and ready to go. So explain to everyone what the book is, where we can find it, and then we'll dive into a little more.
All right. So the premise of the book is that I spent a year inside of a university Title IX system. So that's the system that addresses sexual assault reports. I spent a year seeing it for myself, which to my knowledge, no one else has ever been able to do. These Title IX offices are notoriously secret. They do things like, a lot of them don't take handwritten notes. They don't document a lot of what they do, which is why when we try to get information from the outside, when a case goes wrong, there's very little information to receive. And so in that year on campus, I got to observe a lot for myself. I also interviewed the victims, the perpetrators, and the school administrators who were most involved in these cases and how they were handled on campus. I also did interview people who never met any survivors, but got to decide things like the budget allocated to these different offices. And then I looked over all of the documents I could find, anything that came from the school that referenced sexual assault response over the course of that year. And I followed for a couple of years after I left campus too. What I found is that our public discourse around campus sexual violence, which is sort of this idea that the pendulum has swung too far. What about due process? Look at all of these perpetrators who are being removed, or they wouldn't say perpetrators. They would say, look at the accused who've been falsely accused and how unfair that they've been removed. This entire national discourse where we've seen this pulling back of survivors' rights on college campuses, it doesn't have a basis. That in reality, and some of this is my research and some of this is research that came out since I entered the field, the average university removes one perpetrator every 3 years for sexual assault. So the numbers are way lower than we think, and that most of the time survivors are seeking help because they need something, because the violence they've experienced is interfering with their schoolwork, they are still unsafe, and their school, instead of trying to protect them and help them and make sure they can get the most out of their educations, are telling them, you need to continue to put your perpetrator's needs first. And so what I find and what other scholars find too, is that when this is the way our schools react, it hurts survivors, it compounds their traumas. When you report and somebody doesn't take it seriously and somebody doesn't give you help, it isn't the same as if you never asked for help at all. I think that's what people think. The inaction is kind of neutral. It's neither bad nor good. But in reality, researchers have known for a long time that when you ask for help about sexual violence and you don't receive help, including just somebody acting like you didn't speak at all, that intensifies your trauma with equal severity of being sexually assaulted a second time. And so that's what this book is about. The book is about what is actually going on our campuses and how did it get so far removed from what it's supposed to be, which is around Title IX law. We're supposed to be making sure that survivors of sexual violence do not have worse educational experiences because of the violence they endured. And instead, our entire process for investigating sexual assaults interferes in their schoolwork and guarantees that they will have a worse educational experience than if they hadn't spoken up. So that's what the book is about. And I'm excited about it because for a lot of survivors that I interviewed, almost everybody, when their process of trying to come forward went poorly, they blamed themselves. They said, it must work for everybody else. Look at all this news, this whole discussion. The time I was in the field, the Trump administration had just put out their new draft regulation. It wasn't on college campuses yet. So I got to see what they did when no one was looking. But there was this whole discussion about needing to roll it back because too many survivors were getting too much justice. And victims believed that. And they said, it must be working for everybody but me. And so the thing that excites me about the book is something I was feeling while I was in the field, which was, if you could only hear each other's stories, you would know it's not your fault. And I really hope that's one of the main things people take away from the book as well.
I want to circle back around to something you said, because this is a damn soundbite, if I've heard one. You said that the lack of response that a victim may get is equally damning to them and equally damaging to a secondary sexual assault. Is that what I heard?
Yep.
Yeah. So people don't think about it in those terms. Kim talks all the time about start by believing, and something so simple as believing someone and trying to make them feel not alone, I don't think we recognize always how big the impact is. So the fact that you stated it in that way, I think people can really understand that.
Yeah, it's really big. And I want to say that the state of things right now are really terrible, but I actually think this is an optimistic thing. So the thing that researchers have figured out is that the trauma of sexual violence is not set in stone when the assault stops. Mm-hmm. That actually how traumatized you will be is determined by everything that happens after it's over. So if you get support right away, if you get help right away, if you are taken to safety and you are told that you are valued by your community, you might not find the violence to be as traumatic as if when you go for help, you lose this social status. And that's really what's happening to survivors, is that it's stigmatizing to be a victim. It's dehumanizing to be a victim. And you're experiencing repeated loss of autonomy, where the violence violence you experienced is not something you chose. And now so many people in your life are treating you differently because of that thing you did not choose. And we're increasingly finding that that is where the harm of sexual violence is. And we see a lot of disparities around things like, there's been this trend in the data that's puzzled researchers for a really long time, where when men are sexually assaulted, a lot of the time they don't find it very traumatic. But when you put it into context, the less traumatizing sexual assaults for men are often done in the experience of something like a hazing ritual for a fraternity, where yes, sexual violence occurred. We should stop it. It's not okay. That's not an appropriate way for anybody to be behaving. And we know that men who engage in those hazing rituals are more likely to perpetrate sexual violence themselves because they now think of it as acceptable, not a big deal, as a way to bond with each other. But a lot of the time, they don't find that sexual violence as traumatic as we would expect. And one of the hypotheses that researchers have is that afterwards, you're invited into the group. You are valued. You are treated as you got power and more social status from this instead of less. And again, that doesn't make it okay. We should be looking to end the violence too. But the thing that makes me optimistic about this is that a lot of sexual assault prevention has been trying to change the hearts and minds of individual perpetrators. And I think anybody who's done this work for a while can tell you it's a losing battle. There are some perpetrators who are not interested in changing. Absolutely not. They enjoy being violent. They're going to continue to be violent. And that's just sort of the reality of things. But if we can make violence less damaging, we take away some of their power. And if we can take away some of their power, it can be more difficult for them to perpetrate, which we can talk a little bit more about what I mean by some of that. But as overwhelming as it can feel, I can imagine victims listening to this and thinking like, wow, it is so scary. I didn't realize the stakes were so high. If I ask for help, what if it doesn't go well? Is that going to make things worse for me? I want you to think about the other side too, and that getting the help that you need can be healing and can reduce the amount of trauma you experience. And that's a really, really great thing. And I'll say that in my research, not from this project, but I used to do research and I still do research on queer women's experiences of sexual assault. One of the things that we took away is that survivors have a pretty good gauge of who they should trust and who they shouldn't. And so I know the advice of trust your gut is so tired in this setting. But really, I just want people to know that like trusting your gut about who you can trust can actually make things better in like a really real tangible way.
There's so much. There's so many things here.
I know. See?
What if I bring a flag home with me?
I don't know.
It would have to be like a different color. A black cat.
They're from Ace. They're supposed to mark your sprinklers and instead they mark my... One of the things that I loved about our first conversation is when we talked about this isn't just an institution for higher learning. This is maybe your first landlord, your first involvement with some of those bigger structures. You are learning how to be an adult. So tell us a little bit about that aspect of this.
Yeah, one of the big things that I found the most shocking in comparison to the way we talk about campus sexual assault in public, which is often sexual violence involving mostly two white people, but certainly a white victim that happens in a fraternity. It's this big party environment. Everybody has been drinking. And then there's been this whole discussion on college campuses of can we just make the drinking go away and will that end violence? And the answer is no. The research is really clear. The answer is no. But I was really stunned by once I got to campus and I saw the types of cases that were coming through Title IX, just how rare that story actually was, that there were a lot of other places where violence was happening on campus, that it just wasn't being treated as violence and it wasn't being treated as something the campus had to care about. And so to understand that, you have to understand that our universities are not just classrooms or places for social events, whether it's like a football game or campus parties, whatever it might be. They're more than that. Your university, a lot of the time, is often your landlord. They're the one providing your housing. They are your grocery store. They get all of your money up front for all of the food you can afford for the rest of the year. And so you can't go anywhere else. They really have a monopoly on whether or not you eat. They provide your health care. They might be the hospital itself that you go to, not just in terms of your health insurance, but like the care itself might be coming from your university. They also probably your coffee shop, your favorite restaurant, your gym. And whenever violence happens in these spaces, like the dorms, there's this real reluctance from the university to recognize it as violence and to be as flexible as they would have to be if they weren't your university, if they didn't have that kind of monopoly. And the landlord example, I think, is really helpful here because if you experience violence in your dorm, but the perpetrator was somebody who was visiting, they're not a member of the campus community. A lot of the time, the school will just tell you, like, that's unfortunate for you that that happened. We're so sorry. And that's kind of as far as it goes. And if you decide that you don't feel safe in this place anymore, that your perpetrator knows where you live, you know, you want to break your lease or something like that, a lot of universities won't give you a refund. There are empty units sitting on most universities. A lot of students had their financial aid falls through the first week of class. Those dorms are empty. The school kept their money for paying for the dorm, and they'll keep yours, and they won't let you move into that space. And so a lot of the rights that we would have if we were going to a different landlord don't exist in a campus space, and they trap victims in dangerous situations that anywhere else you'd have some more flexibility to leave. There's this real assumption on a college campus that the university provides everything, that you pay it for them up front, that that's what they're owed because they won't be admitting new students mid-semester. And that if it doesn't work for you, you probably have wealthy parents at home and you can go stay with them. And obviously you're an in-state student, so you can just commute, right? But these rules don't actually work for almost anybody. There are very few students that have a safety net if things go wrong on their college campus. And that means that there's a lot of violence that when it takes place, it can start to unravel the entirety of a student's life. That if you experience sexual harassment in your workplace and you have to quit your job and you can't afford to pay your tuition, you might find yourself without your home, without your food, without your healthcare. It's everything all at once. Whereas in the rest of society, for the most part, if you are not incarcerated, if you are not institutionalized and you have an issue in your workplace, you can switch jobs and not lose absolutely everything immediately. And that's one of the things that victims are running into a lot, that when they experience this type of violence and they start to struggle in their classes, researchers have found, there's a great report that came from the group Know Your Nine, where they surveyed anybody who'd reported to their schools. And they found that about a third of students, when they tried to report, were recommended by their school that they take a leave of absence or drop out, that they leave school. And when that happens, they lose everything all at once. And that was something that I think maybe theoretically I got it before I was in the field, but watching students trying to navigate that and feeling like they had to be compliant with the institution's wishes for how they manage their trauma just became really visible when they're weighing things like, if I drop one class because the professor is being rigid, because the professor isn't giving me any flexibility, and it's at 7 a.m. and I can't sleep because of my trauma, so I'm going to fail this class, but if I drop it, I'll lose my financial aid, I'll lose everything. It just hit me in a whole different way, getting to observe that for myself.
And it is. It is your entire life wrapped up in this space. And they hold all the power and there's no oversight. And I think what's important for everyone to keep in mind is as you're hearing this and the hoops that you have to jump through and the things that you need to weigh and consider, you're not doing that with your brain functioning in its normal way. You're doing it under duress. You're doing it with that part of your brain that is in fight or flight. It's functioning in a way that does not allow you the full capacity to make these decisions at all times. You are in a state of trauma trying to navigate this, which is just above and beyond what you would expect if you hadn't gone through this before. So the idea that there are people that are working within these systems that have never had interaction with victims or survivors or their families is just bizarre to me. How can you decide what needs to be in a budget or what the best practices are to work with these cases when you've got no idea what kind of trauma these people are suffering?
Right. And in that mindset where survivors are often grappling with an assault that happened pretty recently, you know, one of the reasons we care about college sexual violence is not because there are some people who are survivors who might have difficulties in their educations. One of the main reasons that we talk about it is because sexual violence are a hotbed of sexual assault, and that students are experiencing sexual violence. They might have planned all of this stuff in advance over the summer and feel like they have a great plan to be on campus. But if they're sexually assaulted mid-semester, there's not a lot of flexibility to get them out of these situations. And so they have to make decisions pretty quickly. A really good example of this that I get into a little bit in the book, but I want to talk about a lot more, is mandatory reporting. Which mandatory reporting, it's not something people think that it's always been in the law and that schools are mandatory reporters. That's only true for children. Because in most areas of life, we treat adults like adults who have agency and who can make their own good decisions about how they want to handle the bad things that happen to them. And so mandatory reporting was expanded to adults on college campuses largely as a way for universities to avoid liability. That especially after some of these big cases, like the Larry Nassar case at MSU, where there had been all of these victims trying to come forward and the school didn't do anything, the schools were sometimes losing these large lawsuits. MSU lost a huge lawsuit and they didn't want to be in that situation again. They wanted to be in a situation where they would be able to spread out that liability by saying, we're going to tell all of our employees that if they hear something, they have to report it. And if they don't report it just right, well, then it's not the problem of the school. anymore. And I will let you know that nobody knows how to report these things just right. And that a lot of the time people don't report at all. Mandatory reporting policies actually might decrease reports. There's some research being done on that right now. But that's what the indication is that they lead to this culture of fear and anxiety around survivors who self-silence because they don't want to lose autonomy. They don't want this whole thing to go outside of their own plans. You know, it's really tough. It's really tough to find yourself in the middle of an investigation, especially when you don't have time to prepare for it. And so one of the ways that these reports get shut down in mandatory reporting policies is that when a survivor is reported, and that's really what it is, it's survivor surveillance. When perpetrators perpetrate in plain sight, they almost never get reported. And if they do, it almost never turns into action. That's one of the things I noticed in my research as well that didn't make it into the book, but happy to chat about. Anyways, what happens is that this is a surveillance system, right? And so when a survivor is, you know, quote unquote, reported, they will hear from the Title IX office who will tell them to make a decision in the moment. Are you ready to report? Do you want to move forward with an investigation? And so in that setting, it's not surprising that victims who are grappling with often a very new, very fresh trauma that is foreign to them, that they don't have any experience with before, they don't have their support system in place, they don't know how to make that decision in such a short amount of time. They can't even make sense of what an investigation would be. That's another big component of it, that these schools do things in such a difficult way that is really complex and really confusing, that the school that I was at, their investigation process took 18 pages of single space text to explain what would happen if you went through an investigation. And so survivors are being given that and told, can you make a decision? If you don't make a decision quickly, we're going to make one for you. Of course, the decision they make then is the same as they would in their traumatized mind, which is to freeze. The overwhelming reaction is to freeze and to say, just don't do anything. I just need this to be over. I just need to get out of the situation. And so it's distressing in so many ways, because not only are survivors losing their agency again, but they're triggered, and that the university is taking advantage of them in that triggered state of mind, and then pointing back at them and saying, well, you're the one who said you didn't want us to investigate. You're the one who said you didn't want anything bad to happen to your perpetrator. You're the one who said you didn't need help. And so you can't get mad at us. And that's really how so much of the system works. It's weird. Victims are being denied agency all throughout the system, but being told they have agency and they were the one who made this happen, which is very similar to how we talk about sexual violence itself.
I was just going to say, this is a standardized consent conversation where they are stripping you of the actual ability to make those decisions, because it can be taken away at any time for any reason. And that's the opposite of what it seems like universities are doing. I also want to point out that it's not just your Title IX office. When you're talking about a university being all these things to one person, you're also talking about a lot of different departments that then come into play. And when you look at the athletics industry and fundraising and all of those things, not to get way, way off topic, I think Missoula did a really good job. The book, not the university, but Missoula did a really good job talking about how all of these components play off of each other and why that power dynamic is so tied together. And that can be terrifying to come up against.
You know what's funny is, so I read Missoula when it came out.
Yeah.
It was one of the earlier books I read. It came out right at the same time I started doing this type of work. And so it was one of the ones that I read it and I thought, wow, this is so great. I want to do something like this, right? And Missoula is so much about athletics, but it's not that I didn't hear anything about athletics. It's that the Title IX office heard very little bit about athletics, because after all of this attention, there have been all of these structures created to separate athletes out from the rest of campus. And so I encountered a couple of victims who had been sexually assaulted by athletes, and the stories they would tell would be things like coaches discouraging them from coming forward, saying they would handle it informally and that they would remove the perpetrator from a single game. Isn't that better than going through this whole process, which, by the way, is now not permitted under the Biden administration, which doesn't mean that things are going to get better. It probably means that victims will get even less of a modicum of justice. But the athletes, the student athletes, were really separated from the rest of campus. They had their own dining halls, their own counselors, their own entire apparatus. I had one meeting with an administrator who worked in athletics, who was on the hearing board for the rest of campus. And he kind of had this role of being at the end of the line. He had this, I mean, really wild story of originally being a janitor on the college campus, getting a request from someone in athletics to volunteer to be on the hearing board for student discipline. And then sort of moving up the ranks over the course of the next decade, by the time I went to meet with him, he actually had a corner office in the football stadium, and I had to walk through a metal detector and give up my student ID to see him. Not my student ID, my like real person ID. I had to be left at the front door. Compare this to the victim advocacy office, where they face a lot of violent threats on a regular basis, and there is absolutely no security whatsoever, right? So it was like a really embodied experience of who is valued on this campus and who is not. But it taught me a lot meeting him and talking to him about how athletes are being sort of separated out from this process and how much power athletics have on campus to sort of move someone through the ranks that way. Because his main role was to be the final stop in case an athlete was before a hearing board. He would be the one who, while he claimed to be impartial, we kind of know, right? Why else would he have been given all these positions of power and get all of these truly unprecedented promotions and raises that we don't see that kind of stuff on a college campus very often. It's a real testament to just how separate everything was. He was one of the only people I talked to that could tell me and answer the question of, why am I not seeing athletes being reported to the Title IX office? And he said, well, here are all of the reasons. I was surprised by how forthcoming he was, to be honest. But yeah, it feels like when it comes to holding athletes accountable, I sort of have this hypothesis that it requires the press, that it requires somebody from, which happened in Missoula too. These cases were covered in the press because student athletes are essentially celebrities on their college campuses, whether it's because they're in a very competitive athletic program or because they're the only one in town. And so that creates a lot of frenzy around them being the only one in town. And so there is some more press attention and there is some more interest in holding a powerful perpetrator accountable in some way. It didn't seem like that kind of thing would be at all possible without the press being involved. At the school I was at, it seemed really difficult, especially since most of the victims of student athletes are also student athletes. And so there was this sense of, well, I can't report because that'll upset my coach, that'll upset all these people who are all talking to each other. It feels a lot stickier than it did in the era of Missoula.
Do you think that magnification is just because that it is a smaller population? Or would you broaden that to, hey, if you're going to have any kind of systematic change, it does have to involve the press. It does have to involve outside sources applying pressure.
Yeah, I think that there's a good chance that that's true, that it does take outside work. Because in reality, even though there was this entire system set up to protect athletes from getting their cases even into this Title IX office to begin with, and I want to be clear too, that their coaches and people like that are mandatory reporters, so I should have been seeing a lot more cases than I did. But so it's just another time to say that mandatory reporting does not work the way people think it does. But it's also true that when cases did make it to the Title IX office, they're not really doing anything. They're really hesitant to hold anyone accountable in a way that would actually cause some kind of educational disruption. Even in the one case of a perpetrator who was expelled during my year in the field, which is a rarity. Like I said before, most schools are not expelling perpetrators very often at all. It was just kind of a stroke of luck that I happened to be there the year that they did. It would probably be a while before they did that again, if we are going off of what the data would indicate. But in the case of that perpetrator, the university actually got on the phone for him and they helped coordinate his transfer to another institution. He was not an athlete. He didn't have that kind of power and he was still getting all these privileges. So I do think it's fair to say that a lot of the cases that were investigated at all, forget their outcome, but investigated at all, it did come from some kind of external pressure. It was because there was some recognition of, you know, the police were looking into this case. It'll look bad if the university doesn't look into it as well, things like that. And yeah, I think that that's a fair thing to say. And even to create change in these systems, one of the themes of the book is just how difficult it was to change these systems from the inside. That there were some administrators who were trying to do better and they found themselves being pushed out of important meetings, eventually pushed out of their jobs. There were campus activists, not many, but there were some, and they would find their work co-opted, and they would find that they were being asked to do these sort of complimentary, flattering favors. Like there was an activist who I encountered a couple of times. She participated in the project as a survivor, but also I kept running into her because she was really involved on campus in a way that's rare and wonderful. And over time, the school would start to invite her to do things like, can you come to this event on campus sexual violence? And can you be here to make make sure that nobody's panicking. And they would ask her to make these really specific remarks. And there was kind of a quid pro quo sense of like, if you do that, then we'll get you a meeting with the president to talk about your activist agenda. If you do this, then we can make another meeting with you. You scratch our back, I'll scratch yours. And then ultimately, they never really implemented any of the changes she recommended on campus. And even some of the things that did go through in student government, like the school had an affirmative consent policy. As of a few years ago, about 80% of schools do. They were mostly passed through student governments. That exists on paper, but the policies and procedures that schools will use in the Title IX office to decide whether or not a sexual assault occurred doesn't follow an affirmative consent policy. Most of them come from a group called ATIXA, the Association of Title IX Administrators, who at their inception did not employ any experts on the topic of sexual violence. They saw the Title IX discussion to be a way to make a lot of money from college campuses. And a lot of their materials are more misogynistic, they're more victim blaming than people can even really wrap their heads around. But because they don't make them publicly available, and because students can't see them and they're not written on school websites, their internal procedures on paper, it looks like things should be going better than they do. All of this together is for me to say that all of these different ways that people were trying to change the system from the inside, the school just had the power to make people feel like they'd made a difference without actually changing anything. And so that external pressure, I do think, is really crucial for being able to make these kinds of changes. External pressure and also organizing, that a lot of the people who were trying to make changes on campus were doing it as an individual. And I do think there's a chance it would have gone better if there would have been a larger group of people talking about their experiences together and pushing for something better as a group, because it's harder to punish so many people, but one individual is very easy to get rid of.
So for our listeners who are not familiar, talk about what affirmative consent means.
So affirmative consent is this idea that only yes means yes, is sort of the simplest way to think about it. And there are a few different ways to communicate a yes. But if you think of our criminal justice framework for consent, it requires that the victim makes clear that they are not consenting to a sexual encounter. But we know for all of these reasons that a lot of people probably are familiar with, that can be a really difficult thing for a victim to do in the moment. That we have trauma responses we don't control. We fight, fly, freeze, or fawn. And we don't get to pick the way our body and mind respond in the moment. It can be really alarming and shocking to realize how we'll respond. For sexual assault cases, especially with women as victims, the most common response the victims have is to freeze. And in that scenario, it's impossible to say no. It's impossible to fight back. You kind of lost control over your body. And so there was this idea from feminist thinkers to require a clear yes, to say, why is it on the victim to say no? Why isn't it on the perpetrator to make sure they have consent? And so an affirmative consent policy really requires that all parties in a sexual encounter are getting clear, enthusiastic, affirmative, voluntary consent from the other person. The place where it's unwinding on college campuses is that now school administrators are no longer looking for a no. Again, I was only at one school. I say this because I hope it's better everywhere else, but I really don't think it is, because they are using those ATIXA guidelines, and this is in those ATIXA guidelines. But what they're saying instead is that if there's anything that can be interpreted as a yes, we're going to use that as a yes, which is turning into a lot of victim blaming, a lot of slut shaming, a lot of situations where yes to one thing is being misconstrued as yes to everything. Affirmative consent on paper has looked like, again, a really good idea. If people are following it in the spirit of how it's intended, it is the right direction to take. But our schools aren't necessarily doing that, especially when they're looking for really any reason to justify their inaction, to keep a perpetrator on campus and to not have to really... They're trying to not take a side. And in doing that, of course, they are taking a side and taking the side of a perpetrator. And when that's the realm that people are coming to affirmative consent, it's frustrating, but it kind of feels like, oh yeah, it's pretty predictable that yes means yes to them would mean, well, here are all the ways that you said yes.
It's almost like honing coercion.
Yeah, coercion. And also some of the things they counted as a yes are really unreasonable. Even that, I think saying that it's all coercion is pretty generous, because so to give you some example of things that were counted as a yes in the cases in this book, they were things like one victim who was too incapacitated to walk on her own was considered to give, and I quote, clear and unambiguous consent to sexual activity because she removed her earrings. In another case, a victim had said at the beginning of the night that she would only go to her perpetrator's house with him if he promised they would not have sex and he would not pressure into sex. He said, I will not pressure you. And then she consented to some other sexual activities involving kissing and removing their clothes. And that was seen as consent to absolutely everything, even though there had been a very clear conversation of no. And once he began to sexually assault her, she stopped him and said no again. And those no's were not counted. So it's true that coercion is a big piece of this, that one of the perpetrators I interviewed for the book, he talked a lot about how after going through the Title IX process, he was really adamant in getting a yes. And he was telling me all of his different strategies for getting to a yes that include a lot of coercion, things that would make the victim really blame themselves and say, I can't believe I agreed to that. Of course, I didn't really mean it. Nobody's ever going to believe me now. So there'd be a lot of blame. But yeah, so there's that damage. But then there's also the reality that the things that are counting as a yes, I have never, ever thought that removing my earrings would be consent to sex. Never.
I was going to say, that is a totally different take on what were you wearing?
Yeah. Right.
My earrings. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, there are so many plausible ways in that particular case that you could understand. You know, the removal of earrings, it feels silly to even say, but like, obviously people take off their earrings for a million different reasons. In public, I've taught so many classes. I have watched students take off, especially the huge dangly earrings. The idea that that would be considered by the university's consent to sex to whoever's present is just, it's wild.
I take mine off before I record this podcast. I'm not getting on here to have sex. Because right. It's comfortable with headphones on my ears. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, exactly. And there were a lot of cases like that. Things start to look so backwards when the university already has an outcome in mind. And they really do already have outcomes in mind. That's the only way you get to zero expulsions in a given year. Because a lot of people are reporting. I think when people hear that there's one expulsion every 3 years, they must think, well, and this is what schools want us to think. They say, if people would just come forward, no one reports, this is an underreported crime. And so that's the issue, is that our system would work if people would use it. But the school that I was at received hundreds of reports that year. Think of what it takes to get hundreds of reports reduced to one single expulsion. And I think maybe two or three suspensions. I never got a clear number on that. But even in the case of suspension, a suspension on paper, a lot of things that count as a suspension are actually waiting until the perpetrator has graduated and then suspending them after they have graduated, which is not a suspension. It's a non-action. And so reading just the outcomes in the case files, it can be really difficult to know the reality of how this outcome actually played out. So it might look like a suspension on paper, and then there was no educational disruption. There was no consequence. There was one case in the book where that was the outcome, was there was a sexual assault. The perpetrator was found responsible, and he was told that he would be suspended immediately, but it was too late because he was supposed to have graduated. But then he had still had one class left. I don't know if he failed it or if he never took it, but he had one class left that was not complete by the time the finding came out. And so then the Title IX office postponed the suspension so that he would have time to finish that single class, while telling the victim to her face that there was nothing they could possibly do because he was already out the door. And then the only reason that I found out about this perpetrator did not participate in the study. The only reason I found out about it is because the victim had tried to take summer classes and then was discouraged from doing so because he's going to be on campus this summer.
And you're telling me that that doesn't impact that victim's educational experience?
It absolutely does. It absolutely does. That victim in particular, she's the one who I tell the story of just how much her entire life was unwinding as the result of the violence, that the perpetrator in that case had been living in a group home with her. And it's one of those houses that isn't officially owned by the university, but they advertise at like a campus housing fair. And so there was a shared living area and kitchen area, but all of the rooms were rented individually. So you don't get to pick who your roommates are in this kind of a house. And so after she moved in, she found out that the roommate who lived there was violent. His room was actually covered in Nazi memorabilia, which is not a detail that made it into the book. And after he sexually assaulted her, she was really left without any recourse because the school threw their hands in the air and said, yes, we introduced you to this landlord. Yes, we vouched for this landlord, but we're not going to hold them accountable in any way. We're not going to give you access to any of the open dorms that are on campus. We're so sorry that it's finals week, but hopefully you can make something work. And then she ended up having to leave her home. And you can imagine everything that unwinds after that. I won't get into the details of all of the story. It's in the book. But it's that clear example of not just her education, but the school is sort of pretending. And, you know, if you ask them, what do you do about a case like this, where the perpetrator and victim live in the same apartment, they would say, we don't offer any units like that on campus, which wouldn't be true either because they have family housing. When I would confront schools and confront the administrators about how they could justify these actions, they would often point at the policies and say, we don't do that. And I would say, well, there's a student who's in that situation. They got in that situation somehow, and they'd say they shouldn't be in that situation. They say, well, they are. And again, you get back to that experience of talking to your insurance company and saying, I need this medication. And they say, we don't think you do. And you're like, I have been relying on it this whole time. Well, you shouldn't have been. Okay, but I do. And that was the same way that they were feeling. The same way the survivors was feeling was just stuck.
Okay, so there's a few things I want to point out here. One, the updated Title IX regulations.
Yeah.
Now expand to not just protecting students or staff, faculty when they are on campus grounds. It's now off campus as well. And correct me if I'm wrong, your study was completed prior to the new Title IX regulations, correct?
It was before that. So I did my study between the Obama regulation and the Trump administration. So it was the sort of Wild West where the Trump administration rescinded the Obama era guidelines as soon as they came into office. They didn't replace them with much. And so there was this period of a couple of years in between where schools could kind of do whatever they wanted. What they said publicly was, we're not going to change anything because we know new regulations are coming. But I did not find that to be true. They were still changing things and then trying to influence the guidelines that were going to come out, the regulation that was going to come out, to be more in line with what they had wanted the whole time. And so, yes, this is before the Biden administration. I want to point out, though, that one of the things that the Biden administration, so they're getting credit for things like saying, we are going to include any kind of violence that happens off campus if it impacts survivors' educations. That was the law before Trump took office. That is the way things were under the Obama administration. It's the way things were in the circuit courts before that. But you're right, we're sort of returning to a lesser version of the protections that students had in 2015.
I can't find this study to save my life. And I'm hoping that given the massive amount of literature review that you've had to do, I was on a training this summer and the attorney presenting what was included in the new and updated Title IX policies had quoted the statistic about, on average, survivors, 1 in 3 are leaving, dropping out, their education concludes as a result of their victimization. Are you familiar with this at all?
Yes. That is the Know Your Nine Cost of Reporting study.
Thank you. Okay. I'm going to need to go ahead and link that. It has been killing me because I wanted to quote it so badly and I couldn't. But bring this back around. 1 in 3. We know that this happens constantly. And you were talking about 1 in 3 students who are discontinuing their education because of what someone else did to them.
Yeah. And I want to put this into some context because that sounds horrible on its own. But when you put it into the context of the preferential treatment that perpetrators are getting, it's even more maddening. So an example here, the case in the study we talked about a little bit already, but the one where the perpetrator was expelled. This case, part of why it ended in that finding is because the perpetrator was exceptionally violent. I really try to stay away from that kind of language because everybody's experiences of violence and trauma are equal. We know that the traumatic impacts are equal regardless of what you encounter. But in this case, the violence that he was threatening, life-threatening violence, not just for his victim, but for other members of the campus community. He was planning a mass shooting. That's why he was removed from campus, is because he had said in front of a police officer that he was planning a mass shooting targeting Title IX staff. I want to point out a little bit of hypocrisy here, right? That when they are the ones facing a threat themselves, they remove the student. When it's just students, when it's just mostly women facing these kinds of threats, they hesitate. And so I just want to name that really clearly. So in this case, before it reached that point, the school was treating the perpetrator the same way they treated all of the other perpetrators, where after a report had been filed, they were dragging their feet and trying to get him graduated so they wouldn't have to do anything about it. And during that time, it became too dangerous for his victim to remain on campus. And so she did not participate in the study. And the reason she didn't participate on the study was because she had left. As far as I know, she was never recruited because until the case was over, she was not planning on setting foot back on campus. So ultimately, she had almost 2 years of interruption in her coursework. While her perpetrator, they were trying to push him through as quickly as possible. And then only when it became clear that he was not going to graduate because he did become incarcerated, or he was on the way to becoming incarcerated. He's kind of in and out of jail for violating protective orders. It became clear that he wasn't going to be able to leave on the timeline that would be at all reasonable. And so they did come up with this expulsion finding, and then potentially his victim returned to campus. I don't know. But one of the things I talk about in the book is that even if you think that it is unfair to him, if you say, wow, I don't believe in expulsion for this kind of an issue, which you should, and we should talk about why you should. But let's say that that's your reaction. In reality, his victim still had to sacrifice more educational opportunities than he did. He's the one who the university helped transfer him to another school. He didn't have a disruption in his education, but his victim did. That's the reality. It's a big part of why victims are leaving campus. It's because the threat is not over. The violence is ongoing and they cannot safely be there, or they're facing discrimination and hostility from a professor who thinks that they are lazy or that they're not working hard enough. So those departures from campus, people really want to think it's from the trauma, that sexual violence is so traumatic that everybody just needs to go away for a year and you'll come back healed, which is not true. But even the idea that it's from the trauma isn't accurate either. There are survivors who are traumatized, they get the support they need, and they can stay on campus. They can get straight A's with the support they need. But that's not what's happening. There's some other ongoing violent situation, discriminatory situation that is what is leading survivors to have to step away from their educations.
I'm just sitting here and listening because this is all not something that I am well versed in. And I'm just learning from the two of you because I obviously had my experience before college. And so I did not have much dealings with any of these offices. I was working through college. So I just kind of showed up, attended my classes, and I lived off campus. So this is a very new arena for me and just having my mind blown. So I'm just sitting here listening, like many of our listeners may be as well, and just sort of getting enraged. And so this is all infuriating information. So now what? Like, so what are we doing with this?
But wait, there's worse.
No.
Well, I hope that it's time for things to change. There's been a lot of goodwill and a lot of organizing around campuses in the past. And I know that right now we're having this moment of feeling like the Biden administration just put out their new regulation. Aren't we putting this issue to bed for a while? And the answer should be no. We should be fighting harder than ever because the Biden administration broke a campaign promise to survivors. The regulation we were supposed to get is not the regulation we got. And there'd been this concern when Biden took office that he was just going to go back to the way things were done under Obama. And that at the time, activists were saying that what Obama was doing was a step in the right direction, but also not good enough. That survivors needed a lot more protection, a lot more things like funding, that there were all these mandates coming to schools to say, you need to address campus sexual violence. And they did it in the most bare bones way possible, where a lot of campuses have a single victim advocate supporting all of their students or zero. A lot of them are closing their victim advocacy offices. I know my alma mater, which is a small liberal arts college, when they got all of these requirements from the Obama administration, their response was to say, we're just too small. We can't do anything, because that was allowed. In all the regulations the Biden administration included, they say, we trust schools to decide what's most feasible and appropriate for their own campus. And when the school is not behaving in a way that's protective of survivors, that's not an appropriate response. But the way that my school decided to handle victim advocacy is they hire a community victim advocate to take some sort of moonlighting work for the university 2 hours per week. So out of the entire student population, they have a victim advocate who's only answering emails 2 hours a week. And when you have that few advocates, you can't imagine they do much more than answering emails ever. Or that people think there's no way that I'll be able to get in. And a lot of people self-select out, that they say, oh, I'm not going to get a response because how do I find the right 2 hours? And I need something right now. This isn't going to work. I guess I'll go try to find it somewhere else. There was this sense in 2020, when Biden took office, that going back to the Obama way of doing things is not good enough. We want more. And the Biden administration actually compromised and did less. And so I would say the way I would describe the new Biden regulation is that it is a compromise between the way Title IX was handled under the Obama administration and before that, because Obama actually, people don't know this, but he didn't do anything that revolutionary, that a lot of the things that he articulated were already in the case law. Universities had just been ignoring it. They were all out of compliance. They were all breaking the law. And he gave them a gentle nudge to say, listen, you need to do the things you've been legally mandated to do for 20 years. That's really what happened when Obama was in the presidency. But now we have this sort of let schools do what they want, let them pick. Would you rather do things more like Trump? Would you rather do things more like Obama approach? So we really do need to change things a lot. And I'm hoping that having a comprehensive story of what's happening inside of a Title IX office, which, like I said at the beginning, they've been places that hardly anyone has been able to see in them the way that I have. I hope that we'll be able to have a conversation that's based on facts, data, and reality versus the conversation we've been having, which is, well, what if it's unfair to the accused? Now we can say we are not at any risk of that. And actually, let's make the strong case for why schools are supposed to do something about sexual violence to begin with. I think this is something that a lot of people assume it's because sexual violence is wrong and every sphere of society should do something about it because it's wrong. That's not why. The reason why our schools need to care about sexual violence, and I've already gotten at this a little bit, so I'm not going to go into it too much depth, but it's because sexual assault impacts education. Trauma can impact things like memory formation, the ability to pay attention that makes schoolwork difficult. That's especially pronounced if the perpetrator is in the room. That's especially pronounced if the violent threat is ongoing. That's especially pronounced if victims are having to avoid specific educational opportunities because they cannot share space with the perpetrator. That is just a reality of sexual violence. It is a consequence that always happens from sexual violence. Victim and perpetrator cannot be safe in the same room together anymore. Specifically, the victim cannot be safe in the same space as a perpetrator. And that is why expulsions are important. That is why suspensions are important. And I think of it this way. A lot of people think of it as a punishment. They think maybe it'll teach the perpetrator a lesson or this is justice. I don't honestly care about any of that. I really don't. The way I feel about perpetrators is kind of ambivalent, that the rest of the world is thinking about them a lot. So I don't have to. And instead, I think about expulsions and suspensions from the perspective of the victim, which is that if the perpetrator is not on campus, the victim now has free access to the rest of her campus again, to the rest of their campus again. And that's why it's important. And one of the things that I found in my work is that perpetrators are not, you know, there's been this idea that their lives will be ruined, that they will never have another opportunity again because they'll have the label of rapist, which we allegedly take so seriously. But one of the strengths of my work is that I got to see what happened to them and they're all okay. Regardless of their outcome, they're all okay. Really, all that's at stake when we remove a perpetrator from a specific school is they have to go to a different school. It's lenient, if anything, it's reasonable. And I think it's a fair trade. I think that if you're going to really upend somebody else's education this way, it's fair that you're the one who has to leave if that can undo some of that damage. And really, that's what the core of this work is there's this idea that once a sexual assault has happened, it's too late to do anything for the victim. This idea that they're damaged goods, they're irreparably broken. And that's not true at all. We can make things much better for the victim. And so we should. And that's where I'd like to see us moving in the direction of. And I think one of the things that will require, you know, if you happen to be a Title IX administrator, I know a lot of them are big true crime fans, came up a lot in the research, that they spend a lot of time trying to get their training on sexual violence through listening to true crime podcasts.
I'm sorry, what?
We can talk about, we'll circle back on that. But if you're listening, part of this is just doing your job. Part of this is being willing to remove a perpetrator when the evidence supports it. And it overwhelmingly does. A big theme in the book is that the he said, she said case is a myth. It's pretty easy to verify these claims and schools can do better if they want to. But the other thing I'll say is off campus, it's time to take this work away from universities. We can't trust them to self-regulate on issues of discrimination. A lot of these schools did not gender integrate or race integrate on their own. They were required to do so by law, and they've been resisting these changes ever since. And so to think that we can trust them to be equitable when they've made very clear that they're resisting that doesn't make sense. And so I want people to know that there are some examples of how this has already been done in small degrees. So the country of Australia, actually earlier this fall, recognized that the conflicts of interest on college campuses made it impossible for them to investigate sexual assaults appropriately. And they now have a national ombudsperson that students can report to instead. So they have a national office that they've created for this to get rid of this conflict of interest. The state of California has recognized that victim advocates on university campuses could not do their jobs because of the conflict of interest. And I actually testified in support of this bill. It passed unanimously, by the way, which means that like this is a fight that we can, I think, win. I think there's a lot of interest across the political spectrum to be able to do this type of work. But there was recognition in the text of the law and in, they make these little sheets for laws talking about like, here's the impact and this is why it matters. And one of the things that was listed is that when a victim's rights have been violated by their university, if a victim advocate is doing the job of a victim advocate, which is to do what's right for the victim, to put your own beliefs and ideologies aside, you do what's right for the victim from their perspective, you trust their autonomy. And that if a victim advocate is doing their job correctly, when a victim's rights have been violated, they should help them sue the school. They should help them seek legal recourse for that. And one of the reasons there are so few lawsuits around Title IX cases is because we're talking about people whose entire lives are on campus. They're really focused on trying to get this degree finished. And to tell them, you have to find a lawyer, find a way to pay for it, find, you know, all of these things and reinvent the wheel is too much. And so that's something that started in the state of California a couple of years ago is when this law passed. And so what it looks like is the victim advocates are still on campus, but they are not employed by the university. The state is now setting standards of how many victim advocates that should there be, how much funding should they get, what kinds of services should they be offering, and we get to choose whether they're hired or fired, which is really different than what you'll read about if you read the book, where the victim advocates are constantly getting threatened with losing their jobs if they support survivors and they're good at their jobs. So we're not totally reinventing the wheel here. There is some precedent to make these kinds of changes, lobby your state government, you know, write to advocacy groups in the area. But I really do think that these problems are not that hard to solve. That when it gets to the core of it, if we can just make campuses safer for victims so they can remain in school afterwards, imagine everything else that could change across our society. If we have more women completing their degrees, finishing school faster, getting into the workforce sooner, being able to do things like save money for retirement, that's like something people don't think about very much. But if your college degree takes longer, those years that you could be putting into your retirement fund are lost and they're the most important ones. And that creates women's dependency on men in a lot of other terrains of life. And so that's the part that gets me really excited is that even though this is mostly bad news, I will say the book is mostly bad news. It is mostly enraging, but it is optimistic because the problem is we don't know how to end sexual violence. It's just that we're not willing to do it. And if enough of us get together, I think we can change that.
Which is perfect because we are talking about needing outside pressure. I think you just gave us your call to action, but here we have a group of listeners who want to do better, who want to learn and be able to take what they've been listening to over the last hour and some odd minutes and do something with it. So for them, what would you say they should do?
Ooh, so many things. I think my answer to that, I am a true sociologist. And so my answer to what should you do is it depends on where you are in society. And so if you're listening to this, I think it's easy to feel like we don't have any power. But if you read the book, there will be lots of moments where you are screaming at the page, where you're looking at someone in a position of power who wasn't wielding it for survivors. And you can see that because they do wield it for perpetrators. And this is a way I've thought about a lot of my work. So after hearing all of these stories, I feel like I have a debt to pay because it's tough to sit across the table from people who've gone through all of this and to say, I'm just going to listen, I'm not going to help. And so now I'm trying to help. And so I actually opened a consulting company with another sexual violence researcher to try to take all of our knowledge about how these systems fail and work in the opposite direction. I'll say that if you are somebody who you have some ideas for your workplace and you could use some help, or you feel like you want to help, but you don't think you have the expertise, get in contact with us. We'd love to hear from you. We're called Beyond Compliance Consulting. But one of the main things we do is we work backwards. So we look at the kinds of power and privileges that perpetrators are given, and we think about how could we use that discretion to give it to victims instead? What are the things that are within your realm of control to make things better today? And I think as an individual, that's something we can think about a lot. So for example, I'll use a university professor because it's a really clear example. In general, when somebody tries to go to a university professor and say, can you do something to help survivors? Can we teach you about trauma-informed teaching? Can we, you know, say that there are certain texts we won't assign because we know they're damaging, or there are certain exercises that we don't recommend? The thing that you always hear back is our professors have complete control over their own classrooms. They get to choose what they do and they get to choose what they don't do. And so if they don't want to help, they don't have to help. I bring this up because that means that as a professor, your school isn't going to be the one leading the way for you, but there are a lot of things that you can do to help survivors. You can offer them flexibility in your class. You can come up with solutions that work with them. You can be really creative. An example that I talk about a lot is things about, like, if someone's being stalked, one of the main times that they'll be stalked is on a college campus. It'll be at the beginning or the end of a class. If it's a workplace, it'll be beginning or the end of a workday, because the perpetrator will know that the professor or the employer has a designated time that the victim has to be there and a designated time that they have to leave. And so something that all of us can do is just be a little more flexible with letting people come to a place or leave from a place and not getting upset at them if they're late. You know, that for a lot of victims, when they're being stalked, they ended up not only dealing with the violence from their perpetrator, but getting in trouble with their administrator, with their employer, with their professor as well. Things like offering flexibility, trusting victims to make the best decisions for themselves is really helpful. And so whatever position you're in, do that. Whatever that might look like. If you need ideas, let us know. And then aside from that, I would say talk to people about the book. I think that that's the point that we're at right now, is trying to build these broad coalitions of people that are comfortable with removing a perpetrator when they're being violent and they pose a risk to someone in the community. People who are feeling comfortable in it. The main thing that school administrators were feeling was not that they didn't know the right thing. And a lot of listeners probably know the right thing to do too. But when they do it, they feel guilty. They feel like they're hurting somebody. And so a big part of what we need to do is be really proud of the work that we're doing to support survivors. That instead of thinking, the kind of rhetoric they would bring up is this idea of one life was already ruined and that's the victims. And now we ruined a second and that's the perpetrators. Isn't one ruined life better than two? And I want us to get away from that thinking and instead to think about whatever we can do to reduce the victim's traumatic burden is a huge thing. We should be really proud of that work. And don't get into that place of saying, I can't make someone 100% happy. I can't undo the sexual assault. That's the wrong way to think about it. Just be really proud of helping however you can.
Such good information and so helpful, I think. But I don't think you've actually said the title of the book. So tell us.
Oh, I should.
Yeah. So tell us, where can listeners find your book? What is it called? How could they support you in those ways?
It's called On the Wrong Side, How Universities Protect Perpetrators and Betray Survivors of Sexual Violence. You can buy it pretty much anywhere books are sold. If you're in the US, I really recommend an indie bookstore. It's a tough time for them right now. And so I recommend just going to whichever one it is. I just went to the one down the street from my house and they had a copy. And if you're the one who buys it, it will be signed. But yay. I'm not going to tell you where I live. So you'll just have to, you know, go to your indie bookstore and hope you win the lottery on that one. But that makes it sound like I think getting my book is winning the lottery. You know what I mean? I mean it like very
it
much.
There's also $100 in it.
You can also get it from any of the large retailers too. If you are going from outside of the country, I do recommend one of the larger retailers. We're working on a lot of international deals with the book right now, and it will be all around the world before we know it. But in the meantime, that's the best way to get it if you are not in the US.
We will also include a link to this in our show notes. If they want to follow you on social media or your website, tell us about that.
I'm on Twitter. I'm one of the last people left, I think. But if you are also one of the last people left on Twitter, I am there. And as everyone is leaving Twitter, I'm starting to check out Blue Sky. I might be in some other places in the future. We'll see. Blue Sky is where I've landed for now. And my website is just my name, NicoleBadera.com. And there's a contact form. If you have any questions you want to send me directly, I would love to hear them. If you read the book and you have thoughts about it, I'd love to hear those too.
Well, I can't thank you enough for this. Let me know if you just want to chat. I'll just listen to you for hours. I'm so excited to read the book, to make all of the notes, to have, I mean, not that I need the extra fire under my butt, but when you have these things that you know happen, but they're put in the way that you are easily able to read, because you talked about making trauma-informed chapters before, mm-hmm. and backed by data, we're talking 8 years of your life you have devoted to this. To be able to put those things in perspective for folks is just a gift that I don't know if you will ever understand the impact that it has, but I want to thank you, and I can only thank you on my behalf, but huge. What you did is important, and I hope that there are more people out there who are able to benefit from this knowledge, because you have made an incredible impact.
Thank you. And I'm glad you brought up that the book is trauma-informed, because that's something that I think people need to know too. A lot of people are really nervous to open this book, especially if they've had personal experiences. And I don't know how you're going to respond to the book, right? I can't promise anything. But what I will say is that what I've mostly heard from survivors is that they feel validated and that it's helped them understand the impact of their trauma in a way they haven't really thought about before. Not just in terms of what happened to them and the violence that happened to them, but thinking about everything that happened afterwards. A really common thing I've heard from survivors is actually from the introduction, I talk about the impact of sexual trauma on education and on victims' life courses. And people will reach out and say, I always thought it was my fault that I failed organic chemistry. I didn't realize that that's something that so many other people went through. And so the book is really designed with a survivor audience in mind. It is not something where there are no graphic depictions of sexual violence. Even when I have to talk about the intricacies of cases, to talk about evidence, the violence will be described as just a single word as much as possible. And the point really isn't to like shock and horrify the reader, you know, kind of like these conversations I'm sure you're having all the time about true crime. The point isn't to entertain the reader with how gruesome the violence is. The point is really to make it so that survivors can heal some of the wounds from what they've experienced, let go of some of that self-blame, and also understand these systems a little bit better so that we're a little bit better equipped to resist them the next time we have to encounter them. And that's what it's about. And so there are a lot of ways I did that. The chapters are short for a sociologist. Like, I'll warn you, they're short for sociologists. There are lots of page breaks, so there are lots of moments that you can take a little break if you need to. And the survivors are described as people. They're not described as evidence. You'll learn a little bit about what brought each of them to college. And if we don't need to know what happened to them, I won't tell you, because they deserve their privacy. And all of us deserve to be able to focus on what they're really trying to get across to us too. So those are some of the things you can expect. I'm so glad you brought it up. I always forget to bring it up in interviews. And I think it's the most important thing about the book is it's written to be pretty easy to read considering how hard the topic is.
I seriously have not stopped thinking about it since you said that. And I'm like, oh my gosh, all the books that I love to read or got through really quickly or really enjoyed have these short bite-sized chapters or breaks, because I'm sure we have many neurospicy besties out there who, like, in the same way, I need that built in, and it's delivering it in a way that I can still consume that and enjoy it and get something out of it.
Yeah, that's exactly what I had in mind. I've read so many books that in theory I wanted to like, but they were just really tiring. The way they talked about violence, you know, a betrayal on one page can be enough to make it difficult to finish the rest of the book. And so I really want this book to be the opposite of that. I think I pulled it off. You all will have to let me know. But I did really think about it. This is a book for survivors, because all the other books are not. This one needs to be.
Right up our dadgum alley. Well, thank you so, so much for joining us. And we are just hoping that your book is a smashing success and people just really get inspired to ask for change. Because getting people fired up is how change happens. So thank you for enraging us just a little bit.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited. I hope everybody gets really fired up.
Survivor's Guide to True Crime is hosted and executive produced by Kimberly Corbin Rourke and Kara Robinson Chamberlain.
If you love what we do here, please don't forget to follow, rate, and review the show in your podcast player. It's an easy and free way to help us and help more people find the show.
To learn more about the guests featured or to find resources and information discussed on the show, visit survivorsguidetotruecrime.com.
Thanks for listening.
Well, see you later.